So Maximum goes in alone. Terrific twist. Phenomenal. Outstanding of beauty.
A comeback for Newcastle on the pitch could help their Premier League survival bid. But could the Saudi Arabian takeover come back too? New details this week on just what the British and Saudi governments were discussing last year. We'll assess what it all means on this week's Sport Unlocked. Hello and welcome to the podcast digesting the best of the week's sports news with analysis and interviews. This week, our main guest is Steve Cotburn from Amnesty. With him, we'll dissect the new details on that Saudi bid to buy Newcastle. Plus, racism in football. A 10-game ban is handed out by UEFA. But why was the victim, Glenn Kamara of Rangers, also punished? In Olympic news, new coronavirus concerns about Tokyo. Why Christian Coleman, the world's current fastest man, has lost his bid to compete at the Games over missed drugs tests. And news of Russia finding a way of making their uniforms look very Russian despite their doping punishment. Well, joining me, Rob Harris, as ever, is Martin Ziegler from The Times. Welcome along.
How are we doing, Rob? Yeah, good to catch up again. And with us, we have Tariq Panja from The New York Times.
Nice to be with you again, guys.
Back by popular demand.
Thanks to our one listener in Kazakhstan again.
There was actually one person wanting you back. But it's been a lively week in the Champions League this week. I was at Anfield to see Liverpool knocked out by Real Madrid, greeted by a bit of a lively scene on the way in, a haze of red flares, and then encountering the cleanup operation after the Real Madrid bus had been attacked. And the glass was smashed. Could have been a lot more serious.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not the first time it's happened with a bus being attacked on the way to Anfield either. Obviously, fans want to create an atmosphere, a way for their own team to have an advantage. But you know, this issue needs to be stamped out. And like you say, it's extremely dangerous. So far, no one has got hurt. But, you know, a brick or any type of missile coming through the window, plus the shards of glass, it's a matter of time before perhaps, you know, something worse than what we've seen now, as you described, as a cleanup operation, is going to happen. Imagine if someone is driving the bus and it comes through the front window, for example. I think, yeah, there's a fine line between, you know, supporting your team and, you know, really hoping for the best and these sort of activities. It's happened up there more than once as well. So, you know, the club and local authority need to get a grip.
Liverpool did condemn it pretty quickly.
Yeah, they did. I mean, I think it was also slightly surprising that Merseyside police aren't a bit hotter on this because, you know, as you say, it happened when Man City were playing the Champions League semi-final there. And you would imagine with lockdown, it should have been fairly easy to police. I know that the streets around there, and it's quite congested, and it's not the easiest area to police. But you would think they could have a really, really strong police escort, which would deter this sort of thing happening, or a stronger police escort, because it's going to get to the situation now. Every time a really crunch match happens, people think they can unsettle the visiting fans by doing this, because I think it worked with Manchester City. It was pretty grim inside the bus there, wasn't it, back in when that happened? And I think something needs to be done.
Well, Liverpool out the Champions League now. Real Madrid playing Chelsea in the semi-finals. The other one will see Manchester City take on Paris Saint-Germain, or the United Arab Emirates take on Qatar.
Well, it does raise a question about these state-owned football clubs, which obviously also relates to the Newcastle takeover. I mean, there have been calls. I think, is it Javier Tebas, the president of La Liga, has called for such state-owned football clubs to be effectively banned. He thinks it's wrong that a country can own a football club, and it does raise questions about, you know, why exactly is this happening? It's not as though, you know, the British government's going to go and try and buy Juventus, for example, but that's effectively what it is. I mean, a lot of people think that would be a crazy idea, yet that's what's happened.
There was a story years ago, it was one of those WikiLeaks cables, where the Burmese junta were preparing a bid for Manchester United, and that was in one of the leaked cables. That was quite surprising. I mean, I wonder what the rules would have been at the time. Probably would have been waved through. The rules were that lax at the time. And the Colonel Gaddafi as well, he was interested in buying a big football team, maybe Manchester United again. But yeah, you know, the other thing with this at this moment during
didn't
the
didn't he buy an Italian club and get his?
He had a share in Juventus. That's right. The Libyan state did have a share in Juventus, and they also sponsored their shirts with their petrol company. But what I was going to say is that the pandemic period, where clubs are hurting financially and players are injured, etc., because of the number of games, it's the teams that are the richest, got the deepest squads, that seem to have survived into the semi-finals. So you have to look at, you mentioned that you have these two state-owned teams in Paris Saint-Germain and Manchester City, very, very deep squads, very, very deep pockets, the owners. And in the other one, you have Chelsea, which is owned by an oligarch, Roman Abramovich, who spent a huge amount of money in the transfer window just now, built a fairly formidable squad, albeit they had they're recovering from those two transfer window bans, but the pandemic impact, the financial impact, didn't seem to be a concern as they were spending. In fact, they took advantage of other clubs not being able to spend to try and get some of these players in, and they've also reached the semi-finals. And then you've got, you know, Royal Madrid, almost a quasi-state asset from Spain, if you want, in the semi-final. And I think maybe that speaks to our times. You know, the richest and the biggest are in the semi-finals of the Champions League. That's the direction of travel, I guess, Rob.
Yeah, and they're using that power and wealth to try to enforce their own vision for the future of the Champions League as well, as we're recording in the midst of the clashes between the European Club Association and UEFA, trying to get this resolution to bring about the new format and the new control of the purse strings of the Champions League finances. And we've heard the criticism from fan groups, the fact that they're very dissatisfied, unhappy, the fact their lack of consultation on such a significant change to the competitions.
Yeah, we should have a decision on Monday, finally, whether the new Champions League will go through, which it looks like it will. But equally, there's still these undercurrents of this threat from the biggest clubs, like Real Madrid, Manchester United, Liverpool, so usual suspects, I guess, still pushing at the very last minute for what they really, really want is control over their own Super League competition. And, you know, it's getting tiresome. I mean, for the listeners of this podcast, they would have heard us sort of bleat on about it. It's kind of boring as well. I mean, who knows, it would be a boring competition. If it has its logical conclusion, these big teams playing each other week in, week out, that to me suggests it. You lose the element of competition and the interest, etc., but you guarantee these guys that the wealth they have. There isn't a sense that the fans want any of this, I guess.
So we had a big ruling from UEFA this week that a lot was sort of looking how tough would they get on the Slavia Prague defender Ondrej Kudela for racially abusing Rangers' Glenn Kamara in the Europa League game. Well, Kudela was hit with a 10-game ban for racist abuse, but then also Kamara got a 3-match suspension for his reaction, for assault, as UEFA called it.
Yeah, so 10 matches is the minimum ban for on the pitch racism by one player towards another. So I think it's, the more significant is the fact that they decided on the balance of probabilities and the evidence provided by Rangers that Kudela had racially abused him. So I think that's got to be welcomed. The 3-match ban for, there was an assault in the tunnels, how they described it. And that's something that the Kudela's club have brought a complaint to the police claiming that, that something happened in the tunnel. I mean, there has been people saying UEFA shouldn't have done that to him because if he was the victim of racial abuse, then he shouldn't have been punished at all. On the other hand, I suppose if there was an assault, you can't have it's a bit like there's mitigation, but you perhaps still can't resort to physical violence and expect that nothing's going to happen. I suppose the best thing you think if there was an altercation and he has got a ban, maybe he feels that if he landed a good blow, it might be worth it.
There is little remorse or acceptance in the Czech Republic, either from the player or from wider society, that this actually happened. I mean, from an office as high as the Czech president's office has complained to UEFA about its ban, claiming that they've punished a player who hasn't harmed anyone, and he's a decent person and there's no evidence, etc. So, you know, it does leave a nasty taste, doesn't it? If you saw Kamara's reaction at the time, the UEFA investigation has concluded this has happened. And, you know, you get Czech authorities then saying, no, absolutely not, we back this guy. And then you're probably going to whip up a crowd of the team and in the Czech Republic that all of this is still okay and they're the victims. So I can't see this not happening again. I can see we go round in circles with these incidents. We're going to have another one of these soon. We're going to have all the hand wringing and then we're going to have denials, etc. And it's hard, you know, I don't want to be, a glass half empty guy. The guy has been sanctioned in this case, but I just don't see an end to any of this. Equally, this stuff on social media just seems to be getting worse as well. It seems this is sadly here to stay. It's good this guy's been punished, but, you know, I don't hold out any hope that it's going to deter anyone else from doing something similar.
We did see Kudela cover his mouth with both hands when he spoke to Kamara's ear late in the game. And this is something that we would hope counted against him. And actually, we heard this week from Clarence Seedorf, who said players who abuse others with their hands to the mouth should be booked.
That when you're playing on the pitch, when you're approaching an adversary, we're talking about sport, it has to be transparent. So why would I cover my mouth if I need to say something to my adversary? If I talk with my coach, I talk with my teammate, all fine. But when I approach the referee, when I approach another player, another adversary in any sports, you're not allowed to cover your mouth. If you do that, that has to be a sanction. It has to be a yellow card, whatever it is, because we should avoid that kind of behavior.
I like the idea that Seedorf raised about not covering up your mouth when you're speaking, because I actually think there's absolutely no reason to do that at all. I think if you start doing that, it opens the way for people to say things, and then because their lips can't be seen, then they can deny saying it.
Well, this time last year, one of the big talking points was over the potential takeover of Newcastle United by the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, the Public Investment Fund. A year later, it's back on the agenda again, just over why the takeover collapsed amid the Premier League investigation into the potential ownership. There were all the complaints from Qatari-owned beIN Sport about piracy by a rogue Saudi operation. And what we've learned this week is just how much the highest levels of the British government were involved in trying to assess the progress of the takeover, which ultimately would have been overseen by the controversial Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is subject to many human rights complaints and linked to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist in Turkey in 2018. Martin, run us through what we've learned this week from various leaks.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating, isn't it? The bin Salman contacted Boris Johnson to basically threaten that there would be a negative economic impact on the UK if the takeover didn't go through. And apparently, according to the political Simon Walters of the Daily Mail, when Boris Johnson asked his aide, Lord Lister, if there was any news on the takeover and was said it was likely to go through, he replied, brilliant. So it clearly where they can see where his view appears to be. I mean, I think quite interesting, too, that the Premier League stuck to their guns and the fact that they didn't... They had this issue over piracy of Premier League TV matches in Saudi Arabia, and that was the basic reason they didn't approve the takeover. Interesting that they resisted the political pressure, because I think in many other countries in Europe and other parts of the world, they would have caved in and allowed the political force to win.
Yeah, you mentioned other parts of Europe, but they may have seen what could happen if they would have bowed to that by just looking at Italy, for example, where Serie A and the Italian Football Association sold their Super Cup rights to Saudi Arabia for a few million dollars. That seriously undermined their relationship with beIN Sports, the broadcaster that paid Serie A the most for its international rights, and it looks like it's going to lose tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars from that direction. Now, if you're the Premier League, where you have hundreds of millions of dollars in this relationship with beIN for the media rights, it kind of doesn't matter what Boris Johnson wants, because the Premier League teams want the highest TV deals. Now, if anything that threatens, we all know that if there's anything that threatens to undermine the Premier League's TV deals, they'll shut that door pretty quickly. And I reckon that's what's happened here. But you're right, the level of political pressure here is staggering if it's coming from an office as high as the highest office in the land, that of the Prime Minister, and they managed to kind of hold the line on their own rules. And some people are kind of surprised, because in the past they've seen the Premier League kind of bend and fold when it comes to controversial takeovers.
One of the clear things we saw this week was the links between the public investment fund and directly the Saudi Arabian state. It is chaired by Mohammed bin Salman. There was the attempt last year for almost the PIF to distance themselves from being a state entity, but they even had a government website, didn't they, that they run off. And I think we've seen even clearer this week the fact it is a state investment vehicle. So, Tarek, where do we go from here? Is this takeover completely dead, or could it still come back to life again?
Well, it's hard to know. It seems Mike Ashley is determined to sell this team to that particular ownership group. You know, the idea that Newcastle fans, or they just want someone to come in, I think maybe the fans want just anyone to take over, if not Saudi Arabia, just to get rid of Mike Ashley after all these years. But I think as far as Mike Ashley is concerned, he's determined, for perhaps his own reasons, to sell it to Saudi Arabia. And given that he owns the club and he's keeping this alive, he looks like he's trying to push this as far as it will go. And while the arbitration is live, the deal might be live as well. But it's interesting to see. I can't recall a Premier League sale, Martin, can you, that has dragged on for this amount of time? We're over a year now. And I don't think if there's any other buyer out there, whether they've even got a chance of having a conversation with Mike Ashley. He's that determined to do it. He announced this week as well that he's closing the club shop in preparation for these new owners. And that was intriguing too.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the Sky Sports when they attempted to buy Manchester United, that was 20 years ago or more, and that was eventually blocked, wasn't it, by the competitions authority. But that didn't last nearly this long. That was done and dusted within weeks, actually. So, I mean, I imagine that the Mike Ashley wants to sell to this ownership group because they're the only people who are promising him the amount of money which he can secure. No one else, I guess, is prepared to stump up that sort of money. And as far as he's concerned, that's the only thing that matters to him. So that's why he desperately wants to keep it alive. And we will see what happens in this arbitration hearing. I mean, from the piracy point of view, I I can't see there's any way that the Premier League can allow it, because it's such a fundamental conflict with their income, everything they do about anti-piracy measures, and it's that's always seemed to be an insurmountable problem to me.
Well, joining us now for an additional perspective on this is the head of economic and social justice at Amnesty International, Steve Cotburn. Welcome to Sport Unlocked.
Thanks very much.
Well, Steve, you're also a Newcastle fan, so you've experienced and witnessed the many challenges in the Mike Ashley era, all the difficulties fans have endured. And working for Amnesty, you've witnessed firsthand the moral dilemmas in terms of whether to embrace this takeover or not from the fans. What have you made of this week's developments?
I think what the developments this week is clear that it's political. It's a political issue as well, and it's clearly reaching the highest levels of state, both in Saudi Arabia and in the UK, which shows kind of how high stakes the issue is, and how many issues and complicated issues are at play in what is owning a football club. Everything from, you know, diplomatic relations to piracy to human rights, it's brought another layer to that.
One of the sort of regular refrains you get, not just around this issue, but around sort of human rights and sport, and is people saying, why does sport and football have to sort of bear the brunt of these of the sort of human rights issues when there's so much sort of commercial links between Saudi Arabia and Britain, as we've seen with Bin Salman contacting Boris Johnson and effectively threatening that that there's going to be any economic impact if this takeover doesn't go through. But why should football or sport bear the brunt of the these decisions around human rights?
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, I'd say that it's not just sport that we should be talking about. You know, we also talk about the arms deals and many other commercial links and defence links and other diplomatic links between the countries. And so, you know, we and other organisations do talk about that. We took a case to the High Court in the UK to try and get arms sales to Saudi Arabia suspended because of the war on Yemen. I think the role of sport is it's an interesting one. I think we look at it in a few different ways. One, you know, most sporting bodies are businesses, and they actually do have human rights responsibilities in the way they conduct their businesses, in terms of making sure what they do doesn't contribute or cause any human rights abuses, and if there are risks, that they need to address those risks, prevent them, and remedy them. The other angles we kind of look at this is, you know, we know that sport is big. You know, it has such global reach. It's got such emotional power. It's got such reach into our communities that it's of a different nature, I think, to many other businesses, in the way that it moves people. And that's the reason that states like Saudi Arabia have been tapping into sport, whether it's Formula One, whether it's boxing, or whether it's the Premier League, because it is part of their national project. It's part of their, whether it's diplomacy, whether it's about soft power, whether it's about distracting from human rights abuses at home, what we often call a sports washing. And it does have quite a unique role in that. And that's why, you know, when a state like Saudi Arabia tries to buy a football club like Newcastle United, it's not just a simple commercial transaction. There's a lot more going on. And that's why we wanted to highlight the issues around human rights in Saudi Arabia, and to make sure that football doesn't just become a vehicle for other people's projects. And as a fan myself, I'm emotionally very attached to my club, and I'm desperate for a takeover, like anyone in Newcastle. I just don't want my club to be used by someone else for a negative purpose, you know? And there's a bigger fear that's where football's going. I'd rather my club was seen as something really positive, something invested in the community, something that really added something. And I want to be proud of it for that. And I don't want it to be a tool for someone else.
One thing that I found quite interesting over the last year is, I guess on social media at least, this the kind of fans who've got hold of the Saudi Arabian flag or the image of Mohammed bin Salman and put it on his put it on their icon, etc. Is that what you're getting at? I mean, they've got this huge fan base that is now kind of, you know, screaming, "We want Saudi." If you're Saudi Arabia, that's pretty much job done. You haven't even bought the club, right?
I mean, I think the And probably the bigger aim, I would guess, for Saudi is about having, you know, Newcastle on the TV across the world, you know, associated, you know, I assume they wanted to be successful, you know, being associated with the country, with, you know, senior figures in Saudi Arabia, and changing the idea of what Saudi Arabia is. But and you're buying soft power, you know, you're buying soft power in that. You know, I think, you know, getting support and a fan base in the northeast of England is probably one objective, but I'm sure there's a much bigger objective than that. You know, I think there is, you know, the debate what launched, it did make people, some people, quite pro-Saudi. I still think that the majority of fans have a more nuanced view when you take it away from social media. And even on social media, I think that most fans do have a more nuanced view. Most fans, I think, are in favour of the takeover. A lot of fans are uneasy about the nature of who is taking it over, but don't necessarily feel responsible for the, you know, understandably, for what the prospective owners have done in the past. But I think that the project is really, they're looking for to be on, you know, on the screens of, you know, a billion TV screens, on a, you know, winning a trophy and having that sort of the glamour of Premier League football associated with a country that doesn't otherwise have a very good reputation. And they're looking to change that reputation as part of a bigger project.
So for the fans, you said on balance, they'll go with it. Is that being a little bit kind? Is that just because they want to win trophies and they don't care where the money comes from? But at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about, isn't it? It's the on balance part is, if you fall on the side of we want Saudi, surely that means that they're willing to overlook all of the things you've just mentioned because there's a chance of winning something.
Well, I mean, I think that the most common view I get when talking to people is, it's not that they want Saudi, it's they want new owners. I think it became a bit more we want Saudi for some people. The more divisive this issue got, the longer this went in. The more that there was pushback on it, I think attitudes hardened to some degree. But I think judging on social media is not great. I really feel a big difference of when I talk to people who I still get that sense of them being supportive of a takeover and probably even this takeover, but still people do have, you know, issues around that. And a lot of people kind of, I think, try and reconcile that, going, look, we can take this, but we can still criticize, or we can take this and we can still, that doesn't mean I can't speak out about human rights. And that, I can understand that position. I can. I'm nervous that in reality that wouldn't happen. And I think we see in our role is this, if the takeover does happen, that we would use that as a spotlight to speak out about human rights issues in Saudi and to make sure the sports washing doesn't work, I think, is the way of looking at it, you know, you know, because I think a lot of people learned about Saudi human rights abuses through the whole controversies around that. And I think what we and others would do is if a takeover happened, then I think we would want to highlight that there are big issues with that and use that as an entry point. But I don't know. I think, you know, being from the region, people are just desperate for a takeover for understandable reasons, because football is so important to them, to their community, to their city. It really changes the mood of the place. And it's been a long, depressing, you know, 10 years, 13 years or so. And that, in my view, I take a view that I don't want that for my club. I do understand the views of others. As someone who works for Amnesty, or what Amnesty's view on it would be, is that we need to be really alive to these issues. We need to combat sports washing in what we speak about, but also we need to tighten up the owners and directors tests so that we're not, you know, that we're not opening up football for this kind of use and for this kind of ownership.
Did you see the frustration of Newcastle fans and even the predicament they foresee, even something like the Premier League, that even when a US intelligence report finds culpability of Mohammed bin Salman in the Jamal Khashoggi killing, even the US government aren't cutting off ties in any way with Mohammed bin Salman. They're not seeming to actually punish them in any significant way. The same for the British government. And we're sort of asking a sports body to adopt a higher moral code. And you sort of see those, the frustration in the sense of the fans in that way.
Yeah, I can see the frustration in that. There are a lot of double standards at play in a lot of international diplomacy, but around Saudi Arabia especially because there are so many commercial and security and diplomatic relationships that are all intertwined. Often the view that gets, I often hear back is, well, why is it fine for, Saudi Arabia, Britain to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia and they can't buy our football club? And my view is, well, I don't think we should be selling weapons to Saudi Arabia if they're going to use them in Yemen to commit war crimes. And in fact, Amnesty not actually said that Saudi should never be allowed to own a football club. What we've said is that there needs to be an assessment of the risks. This needs to be part of the discussion. There needs to be, it needs to be changed to the test. And if the sale goes ahead, then we need to be talking about the human rights concerns of the new owners and putting a spotlight on them. But I do understand those frustrations. I mean, I can see where it comes from. Absolutely. And people feel, I think that people sometimes do feel that they've been made responsible for what Saudi Arabia has done as a football fan. And that is unfair. And it's not, football fans don't have the choice of who owns them. They do have a choice of how they respond to that. But they don't have a choice of who owns their football club.
One thing we hear from Saudi Arabia often, and particularly when we have things like the Joshua Ruiz fight and the international media's in town and when they've got Formula E, is they point to reforms. They say, look what we're doing in terms of opening up and these events bring about change. Have you seen substantive changes, you think, in Saudi Arabia? How much further do they need to go? What do you make of this PR push when they're sort of trying to present themselves as this newer, open, reforming society?
I mean, I think it's PR is what it is. We've just published our annual report, Amnesty Human Rights annual report last week. And the segment on, or the chapter on Saudi Arabia is pretty chilling. I mean, one of the words in it is virtually every single human rights activist in the country is in prison right now. There's almost no human rights activist who's free. There are no demonstrations. There's no freedom of expression or critics for the government. There's an interesting thing going on there is a sort of opening, and the one, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, tried to present himself as a reformer, allowed women to drive, opened cinemas, hasn't been inviting sports events to try and open up. And that's part of a bigger picture of trying their sort of Vision 2030 project they've got to try and diversify from oil and to try and become a sort of more open for investment place, even open for tourism. Yet at the same time, that's gone in parallel with greater crackdowns internally. I think one of the most telling ones is, almost at the same time as allowing women to drive, they arrested, detained and tortured 12 women who'd been campaigning for that, which is, that says a lot about that. So there's been the openness and the crackdown are happening in parallel. I think I'd be more ready to kind of say that to believe that, you can engage and you can convince and you can try and improve things if there was a national context in which there was an openness to do so, and where you could say that there was a reform agenda happening that you could encourage, and that maybe that engagement would make a positive difference. But I don't think that is the context in Saudi Arabia right now. And I think that's really a key part of the problem.
Was it heartening, given the work you do, to see the players during the international break, during the World Cup qualifiers, wearing those human rights T-shirts, and the fact that they were mobilised in terms of feeling like they did want to get involved in activism, even if the protests were a bit vague in terms of what they were actually calling for? Was that sort of one of those impactful human rights and sports moments, sort of being so widespread for so many days?
I mean, I really did think that was quite impressive, and the way that it carried on. We've been working on workers' rights in Qatar for years and years, and we've been campaigning on that, and we've been calling on football associations to do more to work with FIFA and to pressure FIFA and to pressure Qatar to ensure workers' rights are respected there. And this was it felt like it was a bit of a breakthrough moment in terms of these concerns breaking out beyond the usual suspects. To fans, to players who had taken action on their own. I mean, they weren't asking us what protests should do. They decided themselves what they want to do, and potentially at a risk of sanction, which of course they weren't sanctioned. Maybe it was vague enough to avoid that sanction as well. I can imagine that. So I thought that was really interesting, and it certainly raised the pressure and it raised the profile. And there's been huge discussion and debate over that over the last couple of weeks. And I know from my own work that that has been heard.
Qatar just stayed silent. So did FIFA. Oh, actually, almost just taking the blows.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. They know that they're under pressure. I mean, they know that they have to deliver. Now, will they? Is a question. But and they have done. I mean, I've always sort of said they have been doing things to change things. We would say not enough, nowhere near enough. But there has been some progress. But they kind of know that the spotlight's on, and I assume they know that that scrutiny is probably only going to grow. And I think it does show that there is a positive power for sport to make some changes. You know, I do. There's a big potential for the World Cup to leave a positive legacy for workers in Qatar after years of abuse. Whether that is grasped is an open question, but there is. It is really great to see these concerns being raised beyond, you know, by people beyond human rights organisations whom people may expect to say what we say.
We've heard particularly from the English FA that they're consulting with you over what happens to the World Cup and how they should address the human rights issues. I think the players are due to discuss it next ahead of the next round of qualifying in September. What would you say to a player like Harry Kane as England captain he should say when asked about human rights? He's clearly not going to become some deep human rights research expert to know how to respond to it. So you've got Harry Kane sitting there potentially on the eve of a World Cup game in Qatar at the finals. How should he as a footballer respond?
No, it's up to Harry Kane in a sense what he and other footballers feel comfortable doing. And I don't want to be someone who's saying that, you know, a footballer's have the moral responsibility to speak out on every issue, and they're individuals. They've got issues they care about. They got things they know about and what they might not know about. And I do sometimes think it's unfair sometimes that we dump a lot of responsibility on players, but they do have an opportunity to raise issues because of their platform. And we've seen that clearly with the anti-racism work and other issues as well. And it can be done very well. I think the first thing, it's useful for players to learn a bit more about what's going on, both in terms of the challenges, also the progress. So, you know, you've got a good balanced view of what's happening. You know, there's information that Amnesty publishes that can help with that. And to learn about it and be prepared to speak about it in whatever way they feel able to. That might be a protest. That might be going to meet some workers when they're there. That might be wearing an armband in support of a cause that they care about. That might be at a press conference, you know, speaking about what they hope is the legacy of the World Cup for different groups of people. So there are different options that footballers can do, and I think they can amplify and bring attention to various issues. At the same time, I think we have to be fair to them about, you know, what we hold them responsible for. As human beings, as footballers, as sports people, they've got the you know, I'm very much in favour of what we've got, athlete activism, and how powerful that can be. I think and people should have the space to do that as well. Sometimes in some contexts there is restrictions on what you can do, and I think that, you know, FIFA has some restrictions, the IOC has many restrictions on these things, and it's great that when athletes choose to do that. You know, if athletes have learned and decide that they want to focus on something else in the short term, then, you know, I'd respect that choice as well.
One thing we notice, obviously, on Qatar, and it's the same with the Beijing 2022 Olympics, you as Amnesty aren't calling for boycotts of those events. Is that right? Mm.
That's right, yeah.
We're seeing a lot of growing calls, obviously, and concerns about China, mainly because they seem to completely disregard any sort of questioning of criticism of their treatment of the Uyghur Muslims. Mm. How serious will it get in China? Would it get for you to advocate a boycott? Because I'm guessing you're not getting the access there. You're not getting listened to, as it were, in terms of those concerns.
Yeah, it's a question that we get a lot in terms of Qatar, and I think our decision has always been that there was an opportunity for the spotlight of the World Cup to make a change, and I think that, you know. There was quite a few years at the beginning where there didn't seem like much was changing. But I think things have changed in the last 3 or 4 years. And I think that encourages us that the spotlight of the World Cup is a good lever to do something positive. And that's why we've chosen that. I know others are calling for something different. And I understand that and I respect that. And I think FIFA and Qatar have to, you know, they have to respond to that and reassure people, because I think that call will grow. We've taken a sort of a different strategy in that we think there's something positive to come out of there. China, I think, is a hard one. We haven't engaged quite as much with the International Olympic Committee in the same way we have with FIFA. I think as an institution, they are kind of a bit further behind as well in terms of how they've been incorporating human rights in their policies and decisions. You know, I don't think there was any risk assessment would have been done around human rights or in any great detail around the choice of Beijing for the Winter Olympics. And, you know, I don't see a strategy about how they are going to mitigate many of these risks. And that's something that the IOC needs to do. I mean, that's something they really need to do with urgency. For Amnesty to call for a boycott is a pretty big call. And I think we would have to weigh up a lot of things in that. And that's not where we are right now. But I think we kind of are aware that the Beijing Olympics will get a lot of focus because of, you know, largely because of the Uyghur, you know, the horrendous abuses that are happening there, but also because of the broader system in the restrictions in China as well.
Are you looking forward to the PSG Manchester City semi-final? What do you think that represents?
As a football and spectacle, I'm sure it'd be very good. Yeah, it will beg a lot of questions around, you know, how these two clubs have, you know, become so dominant in their spheres with a lot of money that's come in from different regimes. It says a lot about the nature of modern football and where I personally as a fan don't want it to go.
Steve, thanks so much for joining us on Sport Unlocked. That's Steve Cotburn there, the head of economic and social justice at Amnesty International. And picking up from what he was saying, we're talking about the Beijing Olympics next year. Well, the more pressing concern for the IOC is what happens with the Tokyo Games this summer, the rescheduled Summer Games. And there have been new doubts this week, haven't there, Martin, from politicians in Japan about just whether these games can go ahead with the ongoing coronavirus emergency.
Yeah, Toshiro Nikai, who's the Secretary General of the Liberal Democratic Party, he said, if it seems impossible to do it, then we have to stop decisively, and that cancelling it remains an option. I mean, there's always been a united front in the Japanese government, the Tokyo Organising Committee, the IOC, that the games are going to go ahead. So this is, to me, I think this is a really massive departure. I'm not quite clear why he has come out and said this. What do you think, Tarek?
Well, it seems like the incidence of the virus are increasing in Japan. There's emergency measures now in Osaka and in Tokyo. And that maybe focuses the mind a little bit. Plus the fact that the vaccination rollout in Japan is a lot further behind the United States and the UK and places that like that. We're quite a long way down the road, aren't we? And it seems very normal that we have millions of people vaccinated, and it does seem like there is a sort of a route towards normality in this part of the world, but over there it seems to be heading in a different direction. So looking at it from that side, it kind of seems normal in a way that these guys will be saying that because the virus is taking its toll. And I guess if you're the Japanese citizens, you also want to make sure that you're not having an event that could be a super spreader event at a time when things aren't looking rosy. So yeah, from their perspective, I can kind of understand it, but like you said, it is a departure from messages we've been getting in the last few months.
One person who won't be going to Japan is Christian Coleman, the American sprinter. The Court of Arbitration for Sport has kiboshed his attempts of overturning his doping ban.
That's right. He had his ban reduced, but not enough to allow him to appear at the Tokyo Olympics. He was banned for 3 missed doping tests. I believe he was at a Chipotle restaurant having a Mexican meal in the window where he was due to, where he told testers he'd be home. They reduced it by a few months because they said the tester should have phoned him, but equally Coleman should have been home or should have advised the testers where they're supposed to be. It's amazing that an athlete of that caliber, someone with probably such a big team around him, would be so blasé about following those rules, and it's cost him his place at the Olympics. However, the reduction in the ban by a few months does mean that he can defend his world championship 100 meter title that he won in Doha, I think, in 2019. So no Christian Coleman at the Olympic Games.
Also no Russian flag, name or anthem, but we've had sight of their kits this week and they certainly look very Russian, don't they?
It looks like a walking Russian flag. If you're looking at that kit, you'd see a mobile Russian flag.
Thick bands of blue and red, the same colours, yeah, in the same order.
Yeah, I think once that ban... Once that ban had been reduced by CAS in the way it had been, I think this was the logical conclusion. I think Russia are going to push as far as they can, and but with this uniform, it just shows there isn't much of a punishment here. We're probably going to see hundreds of athletes as well at the games. The only organisation that seems to be taking a firm line still is track and field. We'll see how many track and field athletes are going to be in Tokyo from Russia should those Olympics, I suppose, go ahead.
Well, that's all for this week's episode. Next week, we finally hope to have some clarity on the new format of the Champions League and the finances and the power plays being resolved for now, at least. We'll all be glad of finally putting to bed some of this, won't we? So we're not talking about it endlessly.
Yeah, it'd be good to draw a line under that. On a sort of a more sort of political level, there's the UEFA elections, electing the next UEFA executive committee members from across Europe, and there will be the election for the British FIFA vice presidency, which we have candidates from Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Wales standing. So they're hoping to get a £250,000 a year salary by winning that. Nice work if you can get it.
Absolutely, and also quite rare that is an actual election with three candidates at a UEFA or FIFA level. Normally, it's one candidate for one spot because it's all been done and dusted in the background. So I guess a bit of democracy in action there. May the best person win.
Great to have you back on.
Nice to be with you guys. Nice to see you again.
Great speaking too. Thanks a lot. And thank you everyone for listening. If you're enjoying the pod, we'd be really appreciative if you could rate, review and subscribe to us on whichever platform you're listening to us on. And there's also extra content, and you can also send your feedback via our social accounts. We're at Sport Unlocked on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Whatever sport you're watching in the days ahead, hope it's enjoyable and we'll speak soon. Goodbye for now.